In California's Silicon Valley, the economy is showing signs of a turnaround. Social media companies like Twitter and Facebook are both surging, and overall, there's even been an uptick in hiring. Still, the recession has done a lot of damage, as NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The offices of Frog Design in San Francisco are as colorful and playful as a candy store. The rooms are lined with products the company had a hand in, like a new kind of oven and a charging station for electric cars. Frog Design got its start designing products for Apple in the 1980s, and since then it's worked with some of the biggest companies in the tech sector. Tim Lebrecht is chief marketing officer.
Many people may have a product that we designed in their bathroom or in their living room. They don't even know that we were the secret force behind them.
These days, Lebrecht says, business is booming. Companies are spending again. Profits have been good. And there's even been a small resurgence in the IPO market, with its promise of riches for well-connected investors. Ken Rosen, an economist at the University of California at Berkeley, says confidence is slowly coming back to the valley.
I go down there at least once a month, and the energy is so palpable again in the startup world, the venture world.
Still, the region is a long way from the kind of boom it enjoyed a decade ago. Silicon Valley is a place of almost militant optimism and boundless confidence in the benefits of technology. But the past few years have tested its faith in the future. Unemployment rose above 11%, and housing prices in the Bay Area dropped by nearly a third. Russell Hancock is president of Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network, a kind of public-private forum for discussing regional issues.
There was a period where we thought Silicon Valley might be immune to this whole thing. We're a technology economy, we're export-oriented, but it turns out Silicon Valley is like any American region. We had people in a lot of pain and stress.
Hancock says last year the economy added more than 12,000 jobs, the first net increase in years. But the jobless rate is still nearly 10%. Hancock says the gains in the private sector are being offset by a big drop in state and local government jobs.
For the last year or two, we were using stimulus funds locally. That's now completely dried up, and so now local governments are facing the full brunt of this recession.
He also says there's a fundamental difference in the job market today, and it may not bode well for the region. Big companies like Intel and Hewlett-Packard used to hire thousands of people in the area.
Companies are no longer infatuated with size, because this is how you compete. So companies today are hiving off entire divisions, and they're taking a different approach.
Today, there's a big demand for engineers and software developers in Silicon Valley, but big companies increasingly contract out a lot of the jobs they once handled themselves. In part, they turn to freelancers, consultants, and smaller local companies. Frog Design employs about 100 people at its headquarters, and the company is careful about hiring. Tim Lebrecht says getting too big too fast would undermine the culture of innovation the company likes to foster.
This place would be very, very different if 500 people worked here. We wouldn't be able to create the kind of culture that we want to attract the types of people that we need.
With many companies slow to hire, it will take a long time to get back to the kind of healthy job market Silicon Valley once had. Still, a lot of people are seeing new signs of life in the economy, and they're more optimistic than they were a year ago. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, San Francisco.
Events in Japan have been followed by a string of tactless comments about the tragedy. People have drawn attention to themselves, run the gamut from the press secretary for Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour to the rapper 50 Cent. Comedian Gilbert Gottfried lost his job after tweeting a number of inappropriate jokes. NPR's Ned Ulaby wonders if something about Twitter makes it easier to cross the line.
Gilbert Gottfried was the voice of the Affleck Duck.
Affleck.
Affleck is an insurance company, and you'd think they would have known about Gottfried's liabilities.
And some people need to be reminded every now and then that, you know, not everything is funny.
Right. Gottfried became news himself after tweeting jokes that mocked Japan's tragedy. Most were vastly more vulgar than the ones anchors at ABC News read aloud.
Japan is really advanced. They don't go to the beach. The beach comes to them.
Tweeting almost begs for trouble, says James Poniewozik of Time magazine.
It's immediate. It's unmediated.
if you're a celebrity, it's very easy for you to just get on and thumb something out without it going through your publicist.
Poniewozik even invented a word for the consequences. Twimmelation.
Twimmelation is the phenomenon of losing a job or becoming publicly disgraced over a quick, ill-advised tweet or a series of tweets.
But Gottfried was not ill-advised, according to another person in the business.
We as comics, I think, make those remarks deliberately.
Lisa Lampanelli falls squarely in the same hardcore insult comic camp as Gottfried, and she defended him on Twitter.
With comics like Gilbert Gottfried, Sarah Silver, and myself, anyone who has sort of a shock element to their comedy, it's almost even better because you get an immediate reaction out of people, and I think it's great. I think it makes our brand stronger.
This kind of comedy taps into the id. It's unfiltered, impulsive, all about immediate gratification. And what's Twitter but a sort of mass id, much like stand-up? So you may be surprised to hear comedian Paula Poundstone say Twitter actually involves editing.
One of the things I do with Twitter that I certainly don't do verbally, I think of a joke, I write it up on the thingy, and I don't know how many characters it is until I write it out. Well, if it's too long, then I have to start hacking things away.
Of course, she struggles to keep the meaning.
I try to make punctuation the last thing I throw out.
So a comedian's tweets may be more thoughtfully processed than their off-the-cuff onstage jokes. Lisa Lampanelli says Twitter is deceptive. It feels like a big shared experience, but it's not like a comedy club where performers respond to audience reaction.
When you're on stage, there's the facial expressions, there's the tone of voice.
Lampanelli says there's one line, one she refuses to cross. She will not say anything she doesn't think is funny. Neither will Paula Poundstone. She works for NPR, so she's practically by definition not an insult comic. But she's given this thought, too.
It's funny because I, in fact, put up a tweet that said, due to the tragedy in Japan, CNN has had to discontinue their Charlie Sheen coverage until the end of the hour. And somebody tweeted me back and said, oh, too soon.
That annoyed Poundstone. She was mocking CNN, not Japan. Poundstone says she has nothing to say about Japan that's funny. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, spring is almost here, and I, for one, am ready for it. It marks a new beginning, and that's especially true for those who observe Nowruz, or Persian New Year. We'll talk about the sights, sounds, and tastes of this holiday. That is in a few minutes. But now in our weekly Faith Matters conversation, we want to talk about that 40-day period of sacrifice, prayer, and reflection observed by Christians as they look toward Easter. It started last week with Ash Wednesday, and if you don't observe it yourself, you may have heard neighbors, coworkers, or friends talking about what they are giving up for Lent. The actor Alec Baldwin joked to the Daily Beast that he would be giving up Catholic guilt. But joking aside, it's common for people, even those who are not particularly observant, to temporarily abstain from something that they like. In many traditions, meat or dairy products or sweets. And increasingly, many people are also using Lent as an opportunity to kick or cut back on a habit, like smoking or in all that time spent on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media. But now some religious thinkers are saying perhaps there should be less emphasis on what we give up and more on what we do. Pastor Bruce Reyes Chow has that idea. He's the pastor of the Mission Bay Community Church in San Francisco. And in a blog on sfgate.com, he challenges the conventional approach to Lent. And he's with us now on the line from San Francisco. Reverend, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Now, for people who are not entirely familiar, what is Lent and what is its purpose?
Well, you did a great job. It really is the 40 days that prepare the Christians before Easter. It is a lot longer than that on the calendar, but we don't count Sundays as part of that, so it's actually 47 actual days. But it's a time where we remember the temptations of Christ. We also remember 40 years of wandering of the Israelites. It's a time where we think about the things that hold us back and separate us from God.
Well, no, many religious traditions do have various periods of fasting or abstaining from many things, whether it's food or intimate relations, for example. What is the purpose of fasting in the traditional sense?
There's a couple of ways that, that Christians frame that. One is it's a cleansing and a time to give up those things that pollute, muddy our relationship with God, to kind of purify our bodies and minds. And that's one take. During Lent, when folks participate in giving up something and fasting from particular things, it's a reminder of where we come from. And it doesn't actually come from those things that we eat or the material things in our world, but our life comes from God.
If you're just joining us, I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with the Reverend Bruce Reyes Chow. He is pastor of the Mission Bay Community Church in San Francisco. We're talking about Lent. You pastor a church that, as I understand it, is really young. It's predominantly 20 to 30-year-olds. And one would think that perhaps encouraging people to give up social media would be a no-brainer. But you're saying not so fast.
Yeah, you know, pastoring a church that's in its 20s and 30s, and myself not being of that ilk, I turned 40 about 18 months ago. It's a different world for me. You know, I didn't grow up with social media. I didn't grow up with that kind of technology. I was right at the beginning and the cusps of that. Whereas I think there's a generation of people now where that's the air they breathe. It's the water they drink. It's the world in which they live. And when taken seriously, it's a way that people have connected with in community, both Facebook, Twitter, and a variety of social media platforms, that it's actually how folks are engaging in church. And so I would say that, sure, if social media is addictive and it's holding you back from connecting to God and your understanding of spirituality, then yes, by all means, pull back. But I think that oftentimes social media is allowing people to be church in a way that is unprecedented in our culture today. And in fact, we should figure out how do folks use social media even more effectively to be church during this time is another way to look at it.
You describe that in your blog post. You say that, well, if your social networking or your church life keeps you away from God in ways that you think outweighs the ways in which it connects you, give it up for Lent, and then develop better practices for the long term. But you also say that if you find that social networking and or your church life brings you joy, feeds your soul, and you deal well with all the other stuff, then email this post to the person who told you to give up social networking for Lent and then find something in your life that fits those other two criteria and give that up. So talk to me a little bit more about that. What do you think is a better approach than just sort of giving stuff up?
The blog post was a little bit to push back on this idea that if you just follow the rules, then you can achieve something. Whereas I think you have to look deeper at the meaning of what does it mean for us to really acknowledge those things in our life that hold us back from experiencing a deep connection to the divine. It might be social media, sure, but it could just be how we interact with each other.
Well, just to give people a clue to your own social networking patterns, I will say that your profile says that, and I do want to mention that you were previously the moderator of the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church denomination, which is a position of leadership in the entire denomination. I just want to mention that your congregation is one of the highest reviewed religious organizations on Yelp.com.
It's a little weird, isn't it?
So you're thoroughly immersed. Well, give us some ideas of what other ways that people might explore the meaning and reflection that is intended by Lent. One of the things you talked about, for example, is living on a food stamp budget for a week.
Yes. So our congregation is taking seriously people's lives. And 20s and 30s, you know, I think that there are us 40-year-olds who like to believe that we know what it's like to be 20 and 30. But I think today's lifestyle and pace and patterns are different than even 10 or 20 years ago. And I really am grateful that folks in our congregation would be willing to give up another hour or another hour and a half each week to engage in some kind of spiritual discipline. And so we've challenged our congregation to gather, in addition to Sundays and how we connect online, to gather together for a time of reflection during the week. And through this whole series, we're looking at food ethics and how is our body and mind and soul fed. And one of the things that we're doing is for a week participating in what we're calling the food stamp diet. Just acknowledging that there is a world and a way of living that is different than what we do. And so we're challenging all of our folks for a week, and we'll see how many actually do it, to live on $4 a day per person. It really is very symbolic, and we acknowledge that right off, that most of us know that at the end of that week, we get to go back to having our coffee every day and things. But we're trying to kind of jolt our system into understanding that some folks live very differently than us.
Okay, we're looking at 1 week. What about the other 30 days?
So we're doing a variety of things. So we're doing 1 week that we're going to focus on clean water, both in an urban setting as well as in a global setting. Another week, we're looking at how sustainability works in areas of the world that are impacted by war. And we're particularly looking at an organization called Invisible Children, who is working with child soldiers in northern Uganda. We have a lot of different things that are all looking at nourishment of our soul, nourishment of the city and of the world.
The Reverend Bruce Reyes Chow is the pastor of the Mission Bay Community Church in San Francisco. He also blogs for sfgate.com and the Huffington Post. He has his own blog, reyeschow.com. He blogs, as we mentioned, even during Lent. And Pastor Bruce joined us from San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Only fitting to introduce our next guest with a series of tweets. The social network inside Twitter is celebrating its fifth anniversary this year. Hashtag happy birthday. 3 exclamation points. Tweeting, of course, is like blogging, only faster and more stream of consciousness. Hashtag Gilbert Gottfried. Today, the service has over 200 million users who send over 100 million tweets every day. Are we a trending topic yet? Biz Stone is the co-founder and the creative director of Twitter. He joins us from the studios of On the Path Productions in San Francisco, where, of course, Twitter is based. Mr. Stone, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Scott, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I sent out a tweet inviting Twitter users to ask any questions. You know what question I got by far more than any other?
I have no idea.
Why 140 characters?
Oh, right.
And?
I have a good answer for that.
Okay.
Well, from the very beginning, we built Twitter to work over SMS or simple mobile text messaging. And so the limit internationally for text messages is 160 characters. So that meant we needed to fit all of our tweets within that limit, but we also needed to reserve room for the name of the author of the tweet. So we decided to standardize on 140 characters, and that way you can read and write tweets in their entirety on any mobile phone on the planet.
And how, when, why did you get the idea for Twitter?
Well, that's an interesting story because we weren't supposed to be working on Twitter. My co-founder, Evan Williams, and I had left Google together, and we were working on a new startup, and that startup was not captivating us as much as it should have been, really, for us to be taking a risk with other people's venture capital money. So my other co-founder, Jack Dorsey, came up with this idea that was actually not too far from something I had already tried twice unsuccessfully to launch, and that was a very simple way to update other people with a status message over mobile, and specifically text messaging. And we started talking about it with some others. We started getting excited, and it was actually Evan who said, why don't you guys just take 2 weeks and build a prototype, and we'll see if people like it. And at first, nobody liked it, really. People, for the first 9 months or so, just thought it was not useful, to which I recall Evan Williams saying, well, neither is ice cream. Should we ban ice cream and all joy? And the answer was no. We were having fun. We were emotionally invested in this because it was something that captivated and held our interest.
And how do you get from something that was just fun, like ice cream, to something that has been credited for at least playing a role in revolutions around the world?
You know, when I think about it, it really comes down to a very core basic belief of mine, which is that it really doesn't matter how sophisticated the algorithms get or how many machines we add to the network. If Twitter, you know, if it's to be a triumph, and if you want to call it a triumph, then it's not necessarily just a triumph of technology. It's a triumph of humanity. So how did we get here? We got here because people are basically good. They're basically smart. And when given a simple tool that allows them to express that, they'll prove it to you every single day.
Question from Rav Fox over Twitter. What's the actual business model for Twitter? I mean, how do you guys make money doing this?
Our business model is comes from something we're calling our promoted products, and that's promoted tweets, promoted trends, promoted accounts. The reason that these go somewhat unnoticed by people is that they're entirely native to the system. So a promoted tweet is really just like any other tweet, but a company like Starbucks, for example, can pay to have that tweet show up at the top of the other tweets when people search for, you know, coffee-related terms. We're really just at the beginning of it. This is our revenue model for now, and it's by sort of invite only, the partners we work with at this point, and we're going to grow that as the year goes on.
Let me ask you about whatever role Twitter may have played in revolution in Egypt, in uprisings in Iran, in Libya, political movements around the world. At the same time, are there people who confuse sending a tweet with actually doing something?
No, I don't think there are. I think there are people that are arguing that there are people that are making that confusion, but I don't think anyone's really making that confusion. I think the key thing to remember is that, you know, tools like Twitter are just that. They're tools. They're ways that people can coordinate activities, communicate with one another, and in this way come together as one when it's important to do so. And I'd be the first to admit that, you know, forwarding an email or sending a text message or writing a tweet isn't exactly the same as true activism, but it's in support of activism and it helps. You know, when the Berlin Wall came down, I'm sure there were phone calls being made, but no one said that the telephone brought down the Berlin Wall, you know?
You mentioned that that when you and your partner were beginning Twitter, people ask, yeah, but what good is it? And you said, you know, what good is ice cream? Can't you just enjoy it? can you at this point in your life just enjoy tweeting?
Yeah, it's interesting. Tweeting for me has changed a little bit because what's happened over time is that I've switched from tweeting a lot to consuming a lot of tweets. And that's based on the idea that you don't have to build a web page to get value out of the internet. And the same is true for Twitter. You don't need to actually tweet to get value out of Twitter, and I've learned that to be true.
Mr. Stone, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Biz Stone, he is the co-founder and creative director of Twitter as the site marks its fifth anniversary. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Teenagers have become as devoted to cell phones as they can be to gum snapping or Lady Gaga. They text, talk, and leap at the bleeble of any possible message from a friend, a parent, or Miley Cyrus. So we were intrigued to learn about a high school senior named Michelle Hackman, who won second place in a national science competition. She conducted a study to see what happens when a teenager is deprived of his or her phone. She joins us on a phone from John L. Miller Great Neck North High School on Long Island. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And what did you, just take cell phones out of your friends' hands and start studying them?
Yeah, I was basing my research off of a market research study that basically made the claim that the reason we can't separate from our phones is that we become anxious. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to see whether if I were to do that experimentally, if I were to take phones away from kids, if I would see that sort of jitteriness.
And
I actually found something a little bit different, but I think almost as intuitive. I found addictive tendencies in my subjects. They almost went through withdrawal symptoms. And the way that I like to explain that is that cell phones and other sorts of technology are very inherently stimulating. And so when you take them away, a kid becomes understimulated and almost doesn't know how to entertain himself.
How did you observe?
I used a biofeedback meter. I basically observed levels of stimulation, and I literally saw that subjects who had phones taken away from them experienced decreases in their stimulation.
Now, I have been told you're blind.
Yes.
How does that affect your feelings for cell phones or how you conducted the study?
I think that the one way that it really did play in is that I couldn't actually conduct the study myself because a lot of the readings on the biofeedback meter I couldn't take myself. Mm-hmm. And so I actually gathered a team of other students to administer the study for me. When we talk about science on a high school level, the most important thing is independence. So you've done the research yourself. Well, when you actually look at professional scientists, they're coming up with experiments, but then they spend most of their time writing grants, and then they hand the actual experiments off to their pretty much their grad students and their postdocs. And so scientists need to be able to work well with a team, and I'm lucky that I've had that experience.
Yeah, you won $75,000?
Yes.
Oh, mercy. Now, you just can't take that and have a whole big party, right?
No, the Intel Science Talent Search sends it straight off to college.
Yeah. So what are you going to do? What are your plans?
I'm going to go to Yale in the fall to study psychology, and I'm hoping to bring the cell phone research with me.
Well, Ms. Hackman, all sorts of good luck to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Michelle Hackman, high school senior in Long Island. This is NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Over now to the scene of the other major international story we're covering, the aftermath of the massive tsunami and earthquake in Japan. At the Fukushima nuclear complex, 6 reactors are teetering between disaster and recovery. Just days ago, there were fears at the complex that it might be about to melt down, but now workers have cobbled together some fixes to stabilize the reactors. Nonetheless, radiation continues to spread from the site, and the Japanese public is now faced with contamination of their food and water. NPR's Christopher Joyce is in Tokyo and reports on the situation.
Each day at the Fukushima nuclear complex brings a bit of good news and a bit of bad. The good news today is that a fleet of giant water cannons and fire department tanker trucks have been able to keep temperatures down in and around the damaged reactors. Crews have been inundating the site with thousands of tons of seawater. The water has kept used nuclear fuel rods, prone to overheating, from burning and spreading even more radiation. And engineers have laid a mile-long cable into the site to bring in electric power for pumps and cooling equipment. The bad news is actually outside the damaged power station. 2 samples of spinach taken from a farm 75 miles from the site show radioactive contamination. Samples of milk closer to the plant also are contaminated. In neither case were the levels dangerous to consumers, but Japanese media say consumers are leery of buying produce from the Fukushima area where the plant is. And today, a shipment of Japanese fava beans turned up in Taiwan that showed very low levels of radiation. But the discovery could tarnish the reputation of Japanese exports. Christopher Joyce, NPR News, Tokyo.